Believe it or not, the Bible is actually a humorous book at times, but we often fail to notice the humor there because we tend to approach it in a very staid manner. We approach it in such a way that God seems to have absolutely no sense of humor and is really interested in nothing more than just disseminating theological facts to us, just sort of giving us theological truths. But God actually does have a sense of humor, and it's found throughout the entire scriptures from the Old Testament through to the New. And he often loves to point out the absurdity of our actions as sinful human beings. There are places in the Bible where you can almost hear God sigh and roll his eyes and issue a knowing chuckle at some of the stuff we humans get up to. One example of this, of course, is the gospel reading that we read pretty much every Easter day, the gospel from the gospel according to John. Every time we read that gospel lesson, I can always imagine God laughing at the fact that John felt the need to remind us that he was younger than Peter and that in a foot race to the tomb on Easter morning, John outran Peter. John actually says it two times in the span of four verses. First, he says, "The two were running together, but the other disciple," that's John speaking of himself, "outran Peter and reached the tomb first." And then four verses later, John says, somewhat needlessly, I might add, "Then the other disciple," again John himself, "who reached the tomb first, also went in and he saw and believed." Now you have to imagine God rolling his eyes a little bit and having a bit of chuckle about that. "Really, John? Really? You felt the need to say that again?" Well, this morning's gospel lesson provides us with yet one more example of this type of thing. Perhaps a week and a half or 2 weeks have passed since the gospel reading that we heard last Sunday, in which Peter had confessed Jesus to be the Messiah, the Christ, and Jesus had told them what it means for him to be the Messiah. That is, Jesus told them that as the Messiah, he has come to be rejected and to suffer and to die and to rise again on the third day. And at that time, Peter had rebuked him for saying such a thing because this was not at all what the disciples were believing the Messiah had come to do. And Jesus had in turn rebuked Peter. And then Jesus had told the crowds that if any want to follow him as his disciple, they must take up their crosses and follow him. In short, they'd have to die to themselves in following him, and that's what we heard last Sunday. Since that time, since the end of last Sunday's gospel lesson, Jesus has taken three of his disciples, Peter, James, and John, up onto the mountain where the transfiguration occurs, and he's given them a glimpse in the transfiguration to his resurrected, glorified, and exalted self. And having come down the mountain, Jesus has healed a boy who is possessed by a demon that the disciples were unable to drive out. And now Mark tells us, as they travel away from that Mount of Transfiguration and are passing through Galilee, that Jesus tells the disciples for a second time, he's going to tell them three times in total, but this is for the second time, that the Son of Man is to be betrayed into human hands, and they will kill him, and 3 days after being killed, he will rise again. So for the second time, they have heard what is coming for Jesus. They have heard what Jesus has come into this world to do, what his calling as Messiah looks like. But this time, unlike what we heard last Sunday, no one says a thing. As Mark puts it, "But they did not understand what he was saying, and they were afraid to ask him." Last Sunday, they rebuked him for having said that. This Sunday, they say nothing when he mentions it. There's nothing to say, and it's because they don't understand, and they're afraid to ask him anything about it. Now, the following questions have to be asked. Why didn't they understand him, and why are they afraid to ask him about it? Normally in Mark's gospel, if you read Mark's gospel from beginning to end, you will find that the disciples are actually quite eager to ask questions. They find it easy to ask Jesus questions when Jesus says things that are confusing, things that are perplexing to them. But here we come upon a time where they can't ask any questions. They're reluctant to do so. Well, the answer to this question, the first question, is this. They don't understand him because there's still that level of cognitive dissonance going on in their heads. They think one thing about the Messiah. They expect a political warrior Messiah. And here is Jesus saying, no, God's real enemies are sin, death, and the devil. God's enemies are not the Romans, and God has come to beat those real enemies by suffering and dying under the power of evil. That's how God's going to do it. And as I said last Sunday, they pretty much have does not compute flashing across their eyes. This just doesn't make sense. There's a cognitive dissonance happening. So what Jesus is advocating isn't lining up with their expectations of reality, and they're struggling to make sense of all of that. And the reason why they're afraid to ask him is rather quite simple. They don't want to get rebuked by him again. Peter got bold enough to do it last week, and they all saw how that turned out. And so now nobody wants to speak up and say anything towards Jesus this time. So this second proclamation gets met with silence. Except there's not total silence. No, while they're walking along, Mark tells us, they're having a discussion. And that discussion is absolutely absurd in light of what Jesus has just said. What they're talking about, what they're actually arguing about, that's the word Mark uses, what they're arguing about is who is the greatest amongst Jesus' disciples. Now, this makes perfect sense in light of the Transfiguration. Peter, James, and John were invited to go up to the top of the mountain, and Peter, James, and John got to see something that all the rest didn't get to see. And Peter, James, and John, no doubt, are in that pile wanting to claim some level of superiority over the rest of them. You know, who's the greatest? Well, maybe it's Peter, James, and John. They got the religious experience there up on the Mount of Transfiguration. And in that, you can almost hear a groan and a knowing chuckle from God, along with a bit of a sigh. Really, guys? This is what you're talking about? Come on. And to make matters worse, when they get to Capernaum and Jesus asks them what they were discussing, they all fall silent. You know, pretty much they turn into your kids all the times that your kids were doing something they shouldn't be doing, and you turn around and ask what's going on in that room, and then it goes absolutely silent, right? That's what's happened here with the disciples. They fall absolutely silent because they know what they're talking about is not a good topic and would be quite embarrassing. But of course, Jesus knows what they're talking about. He's no doubt heard them. And so he sits down. This means he's speaking from a place of authority. To sit is to speak authoritatively. And he says, whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all. In other words, greatness in God's kingdom is not measured the way that the world measures greatness. Greatness in God's kingdom is not for those who hold positions of public authority in the church. Greatness in God's kingdom is not measured by the people who have had the best religious experiences or the most religious experiences. Greatness in God's kingdom is not measured by who is the most pious and holy person. Greatness in God's kingdom is about being last of all and servant of all. It's not about, look at me. Look how great I am. Look at how holy I am. Look at the position I hold in the church. Look at how much I do around the church. That's not how greatness is measured in God's kingdom. No, it's about selflessly serving others. And that means it's really tied to what Jesus said last week about taking up your cross and dying to yourself. It's only when you've experienced the crosses of life, when you've experienced those times when you've had to die to yourself, that is, die to the idea that you are in control and that you are your own God and your own master, when you've died to those moments, then you can actually begin to live in a way that is selflessly loving, and you can selflessly serve other people in the way that Jesus would have us do. It's only when I die that a new me comes to life by God's grace, and I can actually go out and serve other people in love the way that the Lord would have me do. That said, there's a trap here. The trap is this. The trap is in thinking that you can make yourself great by making yourself last and servant of all. That's a trap because that then becomes another self-serving theology of glory project. Once again, if it's all about me saying I'm going to make myself last of all and I'm going to make myself the servant of all, I'm going to humble myself and do the work and I'm going to put myself in that position so I can be great because I want to be great in God's kingdom, then you've just fallen right back into the old trap of the self being the center of everything. That is, I'm going to make myself the Lord of all, or the least of all, the last of all, and the servant of all, and in doing that, you've now made yourself the center of everything. And that's not how things are in God's kingdom. That's just really sinful selfishness at work once again, and that's not at all what Jesus is trying to get at. So Jesus is not laying out a path for us to earn greatness in God's kingdom. No, far from it. What Jesus is actually doing in that moment with the disciples, and he's doing with us as we hear this story read to us and preached to us, is we're being exposed to the fact of what we're not. That's what these words are doing. They're showing us what we're not. In the face of all the disciples' talk about greatness, he's exposing the fact that they're actually not great at all in God's kingdom because they don't fit the model of what he's pointing to as greatness in his kingdom. And he makes it a little bit more offensive, a little bit more troubling in the culture of his day by taking a child in his arms and telling them that they are to welcome one such child in my name because in doing that, you welcome Jesus who is hidden in that one, and in welcoming Jesus, you then welcome God the Father as well. Now, why is this a little bit offensive? We tend to have a picture of children in our Western culture today that doesn't line up with the picture of children in Jesus' culture. And this is where the disconnect always happens when we're reading. In our culture here in the 21st century Western U.S., we generally have a picture of children that we try to hold up that sees children as cute and cuddly and innocent. Although if you think children are innocent, you've got way too high of a view of human nature, and you probably haven't spent enough time around them. So maybe you need to do that more. But that is not how children were viewed in Jesus' day. Children in Jesus' day were viewed as insignificant, and they were without social standing. Children were the lowest of the low, pretty much, on the rung of society. They were lowly and they were unimportant. And what Jesus is telling his disciples is that these are the kinds of people that they should be welcoming and serving. The child is a model, an example of the kind of people that they should be welcoming and serving. That is, they should be welcoming and serving those who are lowly, those who are unimportant, those who are insignificant, those who do not have social standing. They should be serving those who are despised and those who are impoverished. They should be serving those who have no power in this world and those who have no influence in this world. And it's in serving them, that is our neighbors, it's in serving them that we serve Jesus, because remember, Jesus has promised that he is hidden in our neighbors. Whatever you do to the least of these, you do to me, he has said. And as we serve Jesus in those neighbors, we are serving our God the Father as well, because they're hidden there. Now, if we're honest, that's not really us as sinful human beings. We would much rather serve those who have power and influence in the hopes that some of that power and some of that influence might rub off on us and get us higher up the social ladder. This is what happens in politics all the time. People always want to scale higher and higher and be put in the place of that person who has some influence because that means they can get higher in life. It happens in the world of celebrities And by the way, the political comment cuts to the right and the left. Don't think it's just one or the other. This is all a politics. It happens in the world of celebrities. People are always trying to climb higher and higher and put themselves in positions of power and influence by the people that they know. That's the kind of greatness we strive for in this world. Furthermore, we do all kinds of what I'm going to say are stupid things in the Christian church, like talking about earning jewels and a crown. You know, I'm going to load my crown up so that I'm great, earn as many jewels as I can possibly earn. We try to make ourselves great in the Christian church by being more religious than other Christians around us. You know, I'll set myself apart and make myself great by being more holy and pious than those people over there. But do you see what we're doing when we do that? We're just being the disciples who are on the road arguing about which one of us is going to be greatest in the kingdom of God. That's what that all boils down to. When we're striving to earn greatness, we're just playing the role of the disciples, ultimately. And in truth, that's comically absurd. Well, thank God that Jesus is not like that. Jesus came into this world to be betrayed and killed and to rise again on the third day for people like us who really are lowly in our sin. We are the despised and we are the outcast because by birth we are all outside the kingdom of God as sinful people in rebellion against God. He came into the world so that he might rescue us. He came into the world so that he might take us children, us lowly, insignificant sinners, up into his arms that he might love us and that he might welcome us into the family of God. Jesus came into this world to forgive us for all those absurd attempts we make to try to make ourselves great in God's kingdom, for all those absurd attempts we make to try to make ourselves somebody before God. And to that end, you are forgiven, my friends. God forgives you for all those attempts that you've made, all those strivings that you might have made in your life to be somebody great in God's kingdom. And in that forgiveness that he has granted to you, and in that new life that he has set you free to live now, as his baptized people, he has now made you great. He has made you to be great in his eyes, because he has now given you his Spirit, and as he has given you his Spirit, he sets you free to love and serve your neighbors. He sets you free with a new heart to actually look at other people and serve other people from a selfless and loving place, especially those who find themselves on the fringes of society. And there are a lot of people who find themselves in that boat. So remember, the way things work out is this, as John says, we love because he first loved us. Amen.